This week, the precious metals breakout came to pass, with gold topping 1330, the best level of 2017, while silver added 77 cents, and Bitcoin came close to 5,000 during the week. Happy Labor Day to our U.S. listeners. We have another big show, two more industry insiders with their take on the financial markets. First up, John Williams from ShadowStats, a listener favorite. We discuss the latest Fed comments, and he's convinced we might just see another round of quantitative easing. Well, the markets certainly seem to think so, with the precious metals climbing higher. And we even wrap up the discussion with the Bitcoin market, and the question is raised, how will endless supplies of fiat money survive Bitcoin and related cryptocurrencies? They have a limited supply and instantaneous, nearly anonymous transactions. How in the world will traditional reserve currencies hold their ground? Then Louis Navalier from Navalier & Associates stops by with a few of his favorite portfolio candidates. He makes a great case for a continued equities bull market for most of the rest of the year, citing seasonal factors and holiday-related buying. You'll want to listen close for his favorite stock candidates. And I'd like to take just a brief moment of silence for all those in the Houston area, plus in the surrounding Gulf region. In just Houston alone, approximately 100,000 homes were destroyed by the tragic Hurricane Harvey and 1 million autos. That's roughly 250,000 or a quarter million facing displacement or homelessness. If any of our listeners feel you can help financially or otherwise, we'll be posting links. Millions of people and millions of pets could surely use your help. There's just nothing like being homeless and maybe even feeling abandoned. People are thunderstruck by this. It came out of left field, and I suspect this will be our greatest national tragedy to this date, eclipsing Katrina, which occurred almost exactly 12 years ago. Okay, and then we have Robert Ian. He wraps up the show with his latest report. Plus, this week, I had an interview with the smarter CEO and co-founder, Lloyd Huang. Although we're still in the due diligence phase on this company, we do find it interesting, so if you'd like to, you can listen in, but do please keep in mind, we're not endorsing and we are certainly not finished with our research here. You might just find the interview and all the literature compelling. And of course, we have a new sponsor. The Silver Corp promo will start running this weekend. Proud to bring on ticker SVM. That's Silver Corp. They have a solid dividend for a precious metals company. And we hope to have some interviews coming up with the key folks at Silver Corp. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector on continued weakness in the greenback on news of weaker than expected economic numbers. Gold added $33, $1,330, just an explosive chart pattern, while silver picked up 77 cents, coming close to $18 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares, though, really stole the show, blasting higher. Black gold fell about only half a dollar, ending at 47, which is surprising given that gasoline futures launched into the stratosphere up almost 14% on news of the Houston tragedy and, of course, the threat of lower refinery output and damaged ports in the Gulf region. Our prayers and thoughts, of course, extend to that area. Meanwhile, the top story sending the precious metals higher, gold climbed on Friday on news the job market had revealed slower than expected hiring by corporate America and weaker paychecks, plus growing concerns over increased military tensions and military presence around North Korea as Russian policymakers evacuated their citizens from the North Korean region, which, of course, supported the case for safe haven assets, which posted the best week in over 6 months. Gold hit its highest level of the year as the dollar slipped to new low territory. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, clearly the dollar fell through support, but then found some strength on lower odds of a rate hike and the growing geopolitical tensions. The CRB index shot higher as expected in the last report as refinery shutdowns in the Gulf put upward pressure on futures. Is this the key gold and silver breakout we've been anticipating for about a year? Well, so far, so good. And can the precious metals rally along, though, with this amazing U.S. equities market? Well, I think that will be a big question on a forward basis. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange on tame yet still solid employment numbers from the Labor Department. The news sent the Dow Jones higher by 174, closing just shy of 22,000. The S&P 500 picked up 34, ending at 2476 for the week, while the NASDAQ added 170, best of show there, finishing at an all-time weekly record close at 6435. The Bitcoin ETF added 6%, up 45, at 800 after briefly touching, wait for it, 1,064. That's tenfold from when we first started reporting it here on Goldseek. While the Komodo coin also picked up a dime, closing at $1.47. Meanwhile, data Friday indicated the U.S. created 156,000 new jobs in August, weaker than anticipated increase, blamed primarily on seasonal factors. Unemployment ticked up to 4.4% from a 16-year low, and the Labor Department noted that wages climbed 2.5% in the past 12 months. That was unchanged and less than expected. The report also indicated that inflation was mostly unchanged. In related news, the Fed meeting minutes indicated concern by policymakers over inflation despite lower numbers. The Fed funds futures contracts barely budged, though, indicating slightly higher odds of a small quarter point rate hike next summer in the overnight lending rate. Bottom line on equities. Well, our favorite seven indicator greed to fear index bounced off extremely fearful levels and now returned to the mean, indicating no signs of greed or fear. So I do think higher highs could unfold, particularly with our positive seasonal factors in the coming months. Coming up after the break, more Goldseek Radio. With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. Goldseek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%, totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
Goldseek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Nevelier runs Nevelier & Associate, also editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters. Welcome back, Louis Nevelier.
Good to be here.
Great to have you back. Are you all in Reno today or South Florida?
I'm in Reno.
All right. Well, we wanted to start off with, the top stories, obviously. On the market, we saw last week's unusual comments from Jackson Hole.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing about Jackson Hole was a lot of people were expecting Mario Draghi to say that he was going to wind down the quantitative easing. But he basically said it's still needed. So that means Goldilocks continues, that major central banks like the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan continue to pump money into the banking systems because debt in all those countries is very low yielding, government debt. They're allowing them to buy corporate debt. And corporate America now can sell debt, you know, overseas in these foreign countries. And Apple can borrow some 9-year notes in Germany yielding 70 basis points. And they can take all this cheap money and buy their stock back. So that's why the market's melting up. We're still in the Goldilocks scenario where we have low rates. So corporate America continues to borrow in the bond market and retired stock. You know, the 10-year treasury is under 2.13 right now. It's incredible. S&P dividend yield is like 1.95. Anytime the 10-year treasury gets near the S&P's dividend yield, it's a screaming buy signal.
I'd like your thoughts on this new competition potentially for Amazon services. We recently read that Google will be partnering with Walmart, of course, to bring sort of a delivery edge to their services and take on the Amazon behemoth.
Yeah, I think there is competition approaching for Amazon. I see it mostly in the Japanese companies, Alibaba, JD. You know, Amazon does not quite have a monopoly yet. And so I think that the fact everybody wants to get a piece of that Amazon pie is good. I'm not anti-Amazon. You know, they're one of the reasons inflation is low right now. But the, competition always arrives. And if Google wants to take on Amazon, they're a formidable competitor.
Last week we saw weaker than expected economic numbers. Do you think this is just an anomaly, just a blip, and we should see the markets find a floor in the next few weeks?
Well, last week it was mostly housing related, and this week it's not. It's, the numbers are good. We're growing at 3%. Obviously, second quarter GDP was revised up to 3. Third quarter should be over 3% despite the horrible aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. The third quarter tends to be strong because our crops are harvested in the third quarter, wheat, corn, soybeans. In fact, a year ago, GDP was 3.5%, third quarter a year ago. We're getting near that 3% GDP growth. Now, what's also interesting, if we can narrow that trade deficit, we're going to be a lot closer to 3% GDP growth. Ironically, the upper revision in the second quarter was due largely to stronger consumer spending than anticipated. They revised up retail sales, as well as business spending. Third quarter is going to be mostly about the trade deficit. If we can continue to narrow that trade deficit, the 3% GDP growth is going to be much more sustainable.
Do you give any credence to the threat of North Korea? I mean, I think the markets have mostly shrugged this off, even though the mainline press just won't stop covering it, and it seems like things continue to escalate almost weekly.
Big bull markets climb a wall of worry, and this is just the latest worry, but ever since I've been doing this 38 years, the world has always been ending. It is what it is. Obviously, North Korea has a serious threat. The fact that they flew it over Japan is very serious. And obviously, we have the missile defense systems and all these stuff that we will continue to use to thwart them. You know, I think the missile they launched over Japan, you know, they launched from a different area. All these missiles are in trucks. So it is very hard to thwart them. You know what I mean? They can put the missiles in populated areas. It's a big threat, and, you know, we turned up the heat, and Mr. Trump doesn't want to pay extortion. You know, he basically says for 26 years we've paid extortion to them, and we'll see how it all gets resolved.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, paid extortion for 26 years, maybe it is time to find a different policy to deal with that region. Might explain some of the reason why they're so upset. All right, moving on to the precious metals. Looks like we're gearing up for better times, especially in the XAU with the gold and silver shares. Any comments?
Sure. All this uncertainty helps gold, but now with financial markets starting to run again, gold kind of had a little burp. You know, it was really strong when financial markets were struggling a bit in August. But with the low rate environment, I think gold will start to calm down now a bit. The low rate environment is just very good for financial assets. So I personally expect the melt up in the stock market to continue. I mean, there's basically four waves underway right now. We're in the first wave where we tend to rally going to Labor Day weekend. It's un-American not to rally into Labor Day. The second wave will be the second half of September when we tend to do very, very well in the second half of September because there's quarter and window dressing. There's the 90-day ETF rebalancing. Mid-October is going to be a good time again just for the next round of earnings. And then finally, we think everybody should be in the pool by mid-November because of the seasonally strong time of year, early January, in fact, year-end pension funding. So we do think this is the first of four waves that are coming that are going to help the market go higher. And, you know, again, as the stronger financial assets get, the more gold tends to settle down. But clearly gold is necessary as a hedge to stabilize your portfolio. So whether people want to have 6-8% gold, I'll leave that up to them. And of course, we prefer physical gold.
Exactly. It's just a part of that free lunch that Markowitz told us about. Okay, give us an idea then as we wrap up on the energy sector. We're looking for maybe $60, even $70 a barrel. Do you see anything that could catapult us to that level?
The seasonally weak time of year is fast approaching. So I realize there's a disruption. I realize there's a big refinery disruption. I think demand for gasoline peaks going into Labor Day, and then it's going to tail off. So I do think any uptick in oil prices is short-lived.
Can you give us candidates for people's portfolios, anything you've been watching maybe at the top of your radar screen?
As the market goes higher, it gets more narrow. We've had a lot of success this year with the ADR stocks, and ADR is American Depository Receipt International Stock. Some of it's China, because China's going to be added to MSCI indices next year, and a lot of people are jumping the gun on that. But we have a lot of big Chinese stocks. Our biggest holdings would be Momo, M-O-M-O, and Webco, WB. That's Chinese Twitter. But we have a lot of Chinese stocks, Alibaba, Baidu. I mean, there's a lot of big ones in there. JD, who competes with Amazon. And so we have a lot of good Chinese ADRs. But we have other ADRs. So we have Ferrari. That's one of our biggest holdings. Its symbol is RACE. And they're all profiting from a weaker dollar, strong global economy. Here in the States, though, we're very tech-oriented. Our biggest holding is NVIDIA, but we have other big techs like Applied Materials. Ironically, we're not that big in FANG. The only FANG stock I have left is, I have Amazon, I do have Netflix. But I actually sold Facebook because they all started to cut the estimates, and then they beat, and then they reversed. But it's like a little whipsaw on Facebook. But, you know, most of our holdings are not FANG stocks.
Can you tell folks more, please, about the websites you have and some of the services you offer?
Research is online free. Our dividend grader is free. Our stock grader is free. You can go to navalagrowth.com, which is my newsletter site. Sign up for our free databases. But people should use this as a sounding board. We rank stocks on an A, B, C, D, and F basis. And A is a strong buy, B is a buy. But people should go in there and key in their portfolio and see how they rank. Hopefully they got most of the A's and B's.
Yeah, the only other thing I'd add here that Navalier & Associates provides a great service where they regularly show a list of, you know, 60, 70 or more companies that have been upgraded from hold to buy. I think that's a great place to start if you're looking to maybe revamp your portfolio. And we'll have links up to that here. All right. Well, Louis Navalier, we appreciate all your thoughts.
Good to be here.
Gold recently topped 1,300, the highest point in months on news the Fed might hold rates steady for the foreseeable future. Joining us with his outlook on the precious metals and the domestic economy, head of ShadowStats, an alternative economic think tank. Welcome back, John Williams.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back with us. And wanted to start off with the price volatility ahead of the Jackson Hole, Wyoming meeting. Evidently, the Fed Reserve Chair Janet Yellen was to address policies at the meeting, but the Fed Bank of Dallas President Robert Kaplan seemed to have some comments on rates that we'd need to be patient, and that caused a lot of volatility, at least in the precious metals market.
There's a major problem here with what the markets have been looking for and what's been touted in the markets, and what's very specifically, the economy is not in recovery. It's not booming along. It's never fully recovered where it had been back in its pre-2007 recession days. It did recover some, but it never got back to its prior high. And if you look at a number of series ranging from production to housing and such, what you've seen is basically in recent years a period of low-level stagnation. The GDP is just booming along. If you believe those numbers, it's up almost 14% from its pre-recession peak. But the housing sector is generally down 50%. You look at manufacturing, that's down 5 or 6%. You don't count expansion until you've recovered the prior peak's high. So not having recovered the prior peak's high, we've had no expansion in manufacturing now for something like 115 months. Which is the longest in the history of industrial production, which actually goes back 100 years or so to the end of World War I. That's significantly longer, 20-30%, than the two prior periods that at different points had actually been the longest periods of non-expansion. The one that was longest prior to this was the retooling in the manufacturing sector after World War II, and before that it was the first down leg of the Great Depression. We've never seen an economy that like this that has never recovered. Yet at the same time, the Fed has been talking up the economy is booming along, and we're going to raise rates because we've got inflation coming, all sorts of happy things. Well, they in their headline numbers, they haven't had the inflation, and the economy's not booming along. In fact, number of indicators, the better quality indicators, are showing that it's slowing down again. The reason I mention this is that that's beginning to become increasingly obvious in the financial markets. With that type of a background, a number of people are expecting the Fed is not going to raise rates as indicated. They're not going to reduce their balance sheet holdings of treasuries that they bought in the quantitative easing. And in fact, what they may end up doing is re-expanding quantitative easing, where that's devastating for the dollar and very good for gold, is that the reverse of that is what's been propping up the dollar from an underlying fundamental standpoint with the central bank. Central bank wants to prop its currency. The easiest way to do that is just to raise interest rates. That's what Alan Greenspan did back in 1987 when he became Fed chairman. Dollar was under heavy selling pressure. I think he came in August. He raised rates in September. The market crashed in October. The reason he raised rates was to defend the dollar. What we're seeing here, what we've seen recently in the last couple of years, is a tremendous amount of hype out of the Fed about, oh my goodness, we're going to raise rates, and then we're going to raise rates, and we're going to raise rates. And with all the hype, they've raised rates a couple of times, but most of the time it was just smoke and mirrors. And now where they've been talking about raising rates again, just that's repetitive. Each time they do that, it tends to support the dollar. But if the economy's not recovering, the markets are reading very simply and clearly that the Fed is not going to raise rates. And in fact, the economy is slowing down. That's a very negative circumstance. Again, the dollar, particularly the Fed, goes back to quantitative easing, which they likely will do, and I'll explain why. The effect there is to, as the dollar sells off, and as the Fed moves back towards quantitative easing, you're going to see significant upside pressure on U.S. inflation. And, of course, that's a very positive element for the picture for gold.
Well, we certainly saw that last week, and we're starting to see signs of it again this week. But, you know, another interesting aspect of the economic story, I mean, obviously we're looking at a disaster in the Houston area. Now, there's the tragedy for the folks there, and then there's the economic ramifications and reverberations that we could feel similar to Hurricane Katrina over a decade later. Do you see something that might prompt our policymakers to take action to support the economy?
It's a tragedy. It's always terrible when you have something like that. You have insurers that are going to take a hit. I'm sure the losses are going to be large there. They plan for this, so presumably the industry would be able to absorb it. Insurance industry, as devastating as it is to the local economy, there are also pluses to the economy there where there's going to be a lot of rebuilding, and it's a mixed picture. Again, it's a terrible tragedy. You have disruption to commerce, of course, people's lives, but there will be some counterbalance there as the area is rebuilt. I don't see it affecting the Fed per se. Near term, it's going to have negative impact, but the economy there will pick up in certain ways from where it hadn't been before. The policy problem with the Fed, with the economy, their primary concern is the banking system, not the economy. All sorts of instabilities in the system when you came effectively to the brink of a systemic collapse in the banking system back in 2008. All the Fed did at that time was do whatever it had to do to prevent a collapse of the banking system. That's in coordination with the Treasury. They just created whatever money, borrowed whatever money, spent whatever money, intervened wherever they had to prevent the system from collapsing. And I can understand that. The problem is that the weakening economy does tend to stress the banking system. So as the economy does weaken here, and at least initially this will have some negative impact, as you pointed out, that does increased stress on the banking system, and again pushes the Fed more towards renewing the quantitative easing, which is effectively debasement of the dollar, monetization of the dollar. I mean, look, my goodness, what happened this last time around where the quantitative easing is still in place. They purchased roughly $5 trillion in securities, and they're still holding them. About half of those are U.S. Treasuries. They haven't liquidated them. The balance sheet adjustment is the liquidation that some people have been looking for. I don't think that's going to happen for a while. I think that's going to end up monetized debt. It's effectively that now, and the Treasury pays interest to the Federal Reserve on the $2.5 trillion worth of Treasuries the Fed's holding. The Fed writes a check back to the Treasury for the interest. It's just money they created. That tends to be inflationary. And as they see increased pressure on the banking system, they'll move to monetize more debt and to make sure the banking system stays liquid. Eventually, that becomes very heavily inflationary. And again, that's a dangerous circumstance for the average consumer who's living in a dollar-denominated world, and is a good encouragement for people to seek safety and preservation of purchasing power with a traditional asset such as gold or silver in physical form, where you can hold them. You don't have to worry about whether or not you've locked in your assets in something that's not going to lose its value over time. It'll retain its real value net of inflation.
You talk about the Fed's balance sheet, and currently at the St. Louis Fed's website, there's been absolutely no liquidation of assets that our policymakers are alluding to and suggesting. Over the past 6 months, there's been a slight uptick.
I'll be putting out a report on that on Friday in terms of how it's affecting the money supply. But indeed, at least as of the latest reporting of the monetary base by the Federal Reserve, it's been rebounding in the last couple of months. That's picking up. The way they avoided that becoming inflationary, and let me just back off, the monetary base is the Federal Reserve's traditional tool for manipulating the level of the money supply. When they raise the monetary base, they're effectively buying assets from the banks. The banks have cash. The banks lend the money into circulation. It helps the economy. The money gets redeposited, and it increases the money supply. They never allowed the banks to lend the money from the prior quantitative easing into the system. They were looking to save the banks, not the economy. They had to save the banks. Had the banks lent that money into the system, you would have seen an increase in the money supply, perhaps a very sharp one, which would have had some positive economic impact and also would have upped the pressure on inflation. But instead, the Fed mandated that the banks redeposit the cash they were getting from the Fed buying up all these treasuries and such. So they deposited with the cash with the Federal Reserve as excess reserves. The Fed paid the banks interest on that. So the banks had income interest from that. But all the money the Fed was pumping in there did not get into common circulation and help the economy. That maybe will change. We'll have to see.
And your thoughts on the Fed funds futures? You know, if we look at the rates there looks like there's virtually no odds of a rate hike until at least next summer. And, you know, if sentiment remains where we see it here, static, there might not be any rate hikes next year at all. What are the implications for the domestic economy?
The domestic economy that's to a certain extent driving Fed policy here, and the economy's not recovered. It's turning down again. If you look at construction spending, for example, a very volatile series that we've seen year-to-year growth there fall off, and it's now turning down in a manner not seen since the housing collapse back in 2006. And if you look at the housing and construction series, the housing starts, the new and existing home sales, the construction spending, very volatile series, heavily revised over time, but they're all showing a similar pattern now. And you smooth them out for a six-month moving average, they're all turning down. We're seeing quarterly contractions. And that's an industry that tends to leads the economy. Again, the housing system collapsed the housing market collapsed in late 2005 into 2006. The formal economy didn't turn down until the end of 2007. But indications are there that it's slowing down again. Add to that that you're not getting a standard recovery in manufacturing. Again, the manufacturing sector's been flat and low-level stagnation. Overall industrial production's higher. That's only due to an upturn in oil production. And that's dependent on oil prices not dropping much further. If you have a big sell-off in oil, that'll hurt that sector. So that's a risk for the sector. But separately, part of the problem in oil prices is dollar strength. The Fed has propped the dollar, and the dollar is beginning to sell off, but the dollar is still very high, and the strong dollar was part of an effort, I believe, back in 2014 to introduce some covert financial sanctions against Russia, given the Ukraine circumstance. And what happened there was the oil prices collapsed as the dollar rallied. I think that largely was orchestrated. And that did put some financial stress on the Russians, but it also killed our domestic oil industry. That was part of an exacerbating factor that still is playing out in the economy. So we'll see how that works out. In terms of the fundamental areas that most people look at in terms of productive economic activity, you're not seeing a recovery.
You know, that's intriguing because we did see durable goods fall by the largest amount in 3 years last week, about a 7% drop in July. Of course, they blame that on the aircraft sector, but it goes along, or at least seems to substantiate your thesis, of a weakening underlying economy, or at least macro economy.
There is a legitimate issue in terms of the how you measure the aircraft orders, because they jump all over the place. They can be up a couple of 100%. That can be a very significant dollar amount. They go up and down. They dropped 70% last month, but they're up 103% the month before. Back out the aircraft orders, or average them out significantly over. Look at the inflation-adjusted numbers. What you're seeing with new orders for durable goods is the same pattern you're seeing with manufacturing. The series peaked back in 2007. It fell off deeply in recession. There's a little bit of recovery, but it's been in low-level stagnation, never having recovered its pre-recession high. It's moving very much in line with manufacturing. You see this in private indicators that are of good quality, such as the Cass Freight Index. You look at overall freight activity, I'm talking physical volume as opposed to dollar volume. That's the way they measure the economy, is effectively net of price changes. You're seeing the same pattern of same ups and downs. It got a little bit higher coming in towards the end of 2014, and then it turned down again, and we're just flat, never having recovered the 2007 highs in the series.
Just shifting gears here for a moment to the retail sector. We'd heard much early on in the year about the supposed retail apocalypse. You know, there are pockets of strength, and we've seen Amazon, you know, do well. Also, the Spider S&P Retail Index surged a bit in recent weeks with companies like Abercrombie & Fitch doing well and Williams-Sonoma. Amazon may actually have some competition. Evidently, Google is partnering with Walmart to give free delivery over certain prices in their attempt to break into Amazon's home delivery business.
Personally, I much prefer going to a good quality retail store where I can look at the goods and get a sense as to the quality of it. And if I like it or look at it around, it's much easier than shopping online and hoping that you get something that you like. I don't like the concept myself, but I'm probably too old-fashioned. Well, the retail sales is several-fold. First, the way you get the headline numbers reported, that's in nominal terms. That's before inflation adjustment. The way the economy's measured is usually net of inflation. The reason for that is if your retail sales are up 10% over last year, and you say, wow, my retail sales are up 10%, If inflation's up 10%, though, and your prices are 10% higher, it's only because you raised your prices. It's not because you're getting a higher physical volume. There's a problem with the inflation numbers, headline consumer inflation numbers, which are used in deflating the retail sales, which goes back to the 90s when the government decided that it would recast the way of calculating consumer inflation to reduce the headline inflation rate. The reason they were doing that was very deliberate, and they were very open about it, led by Alan Greenspan of the Fed endorsed by all involved administrations, if you could reduce the rate of inflation, the headline rate of inflation, the way it was reported, that would reduce cost of living adjustments for people on Social Security, for example, as it would affect people's income in the tax payment arrangements. It would boost people into higher tax brackets, and they'd also get increased revenue there. This is all a gimmick to effectively tax people covertly, and I take strong objection to that. If you're going to raise taxes, raise taxes, but don't try and fool people on what the rate of inflation is. Go through all the niceties of what the government thinks it should do. Keep in mind that the basic concept behind a consumer price index over the decades, actually over the centuries, has been to measure the cost of maintaining a constant standard of living. So that you look at, let's say, the way the series used to be calculated, very simple terms, they'd price out, let's say, a pound of beef, a gallon of gas, a loaf of bread. 1 year, then they'd measure the same three products the next year, and whatever the difference was in the prices, that would be your rate of inflation, measuring what they refer to as a constant basket of goods. The objection that Greenspan raised was, well, my goodness, if prices go up on steak and steak becomes too expensive, people buy more hamburger. Buy more hamburger, then their cost of living isn't as high. That's not measured in the CPI. No, it wasn't measured in the CPI because the concept was not one of substituting lower quality goods because you couldn't afford to buy the higher quality goods. The question was, how much is inflation going up so that you can make sure your income keeps up with that and you can continue to maintain your lifestyle? But they moved the system over towards a substitution-based CPI. If you're taking something such as retail sales and you're adjusting it for inflation, putting it in what they call constant dollar terms, the way the GDP's reported, if you understate the rate of inflation, you overstate the inflation-adjusted growth. Even inflation-adjusted, you'll find that the headline numbers, given headline CPI inflation, are growing as well. But if you take out the substitution gimmicks that they put into the CPI, you're not seeing the growth there. You're seeing the same pattern that you've got otherwise, low-level stagnation in real terms, not in the nominal terms before inflation adjustment.
Clearly, people are concerned that after, I don't know, a number of years of the greenback having a chance to stage an impressive new uptrend, that's just all fizzled out. I mean, the dollar has plunged to lows not seen in several years. I think you could make the argument that it's broken the uptrend. We'll have to wait and see how things will unfold. A sea change event, and it might bode well for the precious metals, which have stagnated for a few years. Any additional comments on gold and silver?
You probably have seen the peak in the dollar and correspondingly trough in domestic inflation and a trough in the gold and silver prices. Now, those are all markets that can be intervened in at will by the central banks, but if they're going against market pressures, it becomes uneconomical to do so for an extended period of time. Nonetheless, they do occasionally slam gold prices to discourage its ownership, and intervention is usually effective in terms of moving a currency value, but unless you have underlying fundamental support for the currency, that becomes very expensive. Consider, again, back in 1987, what do you do fundamentally to support a currency? Well, what Greenspan did was he raised rates. But that was not too popular with the financial markets. People would sometimes view that as being a negative for the economy. So what was happening is you came into the stock market crash in October of 87. The week before, you had a terrible down day on Friday. It was down something like 150 points. Which in those days was a very big percentage, and I think it was probably the biggest percentage drop, or certainly the largest drop in a long time. Over the weekend, people were nervous about what was going to happen on Monday, nobody for sure. In Washington, the politicians got together and worked things out, among other things. Our Treasury Secretary then, who's James Baker, came out on Saturday to say that the United States was no longer going to support the dollar against the Deutsche Mark. Well, I'd cut my teeth in the currency market I mean, Nixon floated the dollar, so that's about the time I came in and got involved in the currencies. I knew that was going to give you dollar selling panic come Monday morning, and that would likely trigger a stock selling panic. When the dollar's weak, that's generally bad news for stocks, where the market is heavily dependent on foreign capital as it is now. What you've had, the Fed has been artificially propping the dollar here, with all of its rate talk and such. That's drawing in foreign capital into the stock and credit markets. And as the dollar starts to fall here, you're going to see increased selling pressure both in the equities and on the credit market side, which means some upside pressure on interest rates.
Okay, and as we wrap up today, we here at GoldSeek are starting to embrace and see some amazing opportunities and possibilities, and that's the cryptocurrency space. We've gone from roughly a $50 billion market cap on Bitcoin and related cryptocurrencies to $150-plus billion in just a few months' time. And many top VCs, venture capitalists, and some economists are calling for this market to rival the Forex, a $5 trillion market within 5 to 10 years. We actually support that thesis and believe that digital money will not replace any fiat money. It will simply be a competing parallel market, just as the VHS and DVD and then DVR all just paralleled the, you know, movie markets and cable TV and whatnot. I guess the real question for you, sir, is whether or not you believe that cryptocurrencies will actually continue to undermine and debase the reserve currency. How do fiat currencies compete in a market where there is a limited supply, no additional currency can be created, there is great demand and incredible usefulness in aspects that traditional fiat money do not have?
Well, it's an interesting question, an interesting market, an interesting phenomenon. It's, you know, as long as you don't have a financial panic and a collapse of the dollar, you know, what you're talking about may come to pass. Problem is, I don't think we're going to get that far. I think what's happening now with the economy is going to kill the prospects of the Fed's stabilizing the system as they'd hoped. The problem is the system collapsed effectively back in the banking panic in 2008. The Fed can't get the economy growing here, which is one reason it's not growing is because of the way they bailed out the banking system. But guess what? If they hadn't bailed out the banking system, you would have had an economic collapse, too. They haven't been able to get things back into a normal course. The system has just never recovered. And if the Fed has to go back towards its quantitative easing, the currency markets are going to fall apart. At least the dollar is going to fall apart very quickly. And as it does, you're going to see a spike in domestic inflation, which will also create a traditional move to the precious metals. What happens there, I still look for an environment that's going to evolve into a hyperinflation. We have a circumstance right now where the U.S. government, total unfunded liabilities, net present value, plus liabilities that are in place right now. So there's nothing there about the unfunded are generally obligations like Social Security, Medicare. Then you have the debt, which is around $20 trillion and such. You're in excess of $100 trillion. There's no way that the federal government can ever cover that, which means eventually they either have to bring the system into balance, which is a painful process, but it's better done sooner rather than later. Or if they can't, it means eventual debasement of the full debasement of the dollar. You see a dollar panic now, it could trigger tremendous flight from the dollar. Big spike in domestic inflation and an exacerbating circumstance that still can evolve into hyperinflation. If you get into hyperinflation and the type of domestic crisis that it creates in terms of systemic functionality, I don't know that you're going to have your electronic system working. If you own physical gold, you have the precious metal in hand, and frankly, I'd rather hold the precious gold than the equivalent in electronic assets, but that's just because I'm perhaps a little more conservative than some people are.
You can purchase now a physical non-electronic wallet. It's a tiny piece of plastic with a gold leaf on it. Plug it into your USB outlet and download onto a non-digital, non-electronic wallet and freeze your digital assets, meaning Bitcoin, Litecoin, any other digital asset, which, of course, now that's the big trend, stocks, bonds, and many, many other balance sheet assets into the digital realm. This revolution might be an interesting addition to the home safe, if you will, or the safe deposit box, because unlike gold and silver, which we are huge proponents of here, it keeps the lights on. We're grateful for that. Digital money can be transferred, and it can, regardless of what people are telling people today, anonymously, using many different methods around the world, of course, in the blink of an eye, peer-to-peer. There's really nothing in the history of economic history so far that offered that ability. It's unique. Here's an example. I mean, just moving diamonds across borders or gold today is a great challenge for many people, and with monetary controls.
I follow you saying there, and it's a very interesting concept, and, you know, as long as you're aware of the risks with it and you like the benefits, that's fine. What I'm looking at is battening down the hatches and surviving end-of-the-world type financial scenarios where you may not have access to networks where you can transfer these things or where it might even be recognized. And I'm not saying that's going to happen. But just consider, in terms of physical gold, that not only does it tend to retain its value, but it's also very good for bribing border guards and officials if you're in trouble, you want to get across a border in very difficult times. I mean, I know the people who owe their lives to gold because they're able to bribe away across borders in pre-World War II Europe. I still view the holding the physical metal as being the ultimate safety factor, but what you're describing there has got a lot of benefit as well, as long as you're still able to function. Having both, you've got benefits of both. If I had to give up one thing last, it would be physical.
I think it's well said, and I would just add to your thoughts, hold the physical gold and silver. It's the ideal store and crystallization of one's wealth and efforts. You did mention crossing borders. Many of our listeners, you know, they fall into the millionaire camp. Trying to cross a border with $1 million of gold or silver today would be challenging as opposed to, let's say, 1939 or 45 Europe, because of the way metal detectors and scanning, in a handheld device for $40, I mean, they can find things that just would have been impossible in the past. And I would note that many hundreds of millions of dollars of Bitcoin can be held on a plastic, non-detectable device, the competing safe haven for people. There's the potential opportunity costs of watching Bitcoin soar from what we think will be around 4,000 to 50 and then onwards, well above 100,000 in the next few years. And there's a lot of support for that I won't go into here. So we want people to start thinking about digital money in tandem with the precious metals. John Williams, just a pleasure. Please tell us more about this website, ShadowStats, all the alternative economic research.
My website is shadowstats.com. I have posted on that, you look in the right-hand side of the homepage, a number of background articles on underlying economic reality. Also have a weekly commentary, which people can subscribe to. It's $175 a year. $89 for 6 months. But if you look at the left-hand column there, it gives you the headlines from the newsletters. It generally gives you an idea as to what we're looking at. We always welcome new subscribers, and we keep updating the site with the background information that people find of value. They're most welcome to.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to welcome the co-founder and CEO of Smarter, and rather interesting company here. He has over 15 years of entrepreneurial, operational, and management sales, and worn all the hats in the company. Lots of experience with startups in multiple markets. Welcome to the show, Lloyd Huang.
Thanks so much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
I'd like for folks to hear about your real-world experience. I mean, your last startup, this was a Silicon Valley slash China-based startup. It went public on the New York Stock Exchange. We're talking, you know, the traditional IPO raised, I think, something like $8 to $10 billion. I mean, this is pretty exciting. I think you ended up generating in the neighborhood of $150 million in sales over 24 months. Can you tell us more, please?
Startup is actually in semiconductors, and my background is in electrical engineering with emphasis in supercomputing and VLSI design. And I joined that company in 2001 when it was just, you know, a bunch of us trying to come up with attacking this niche market, at that time a niche market that's bridging China and the United States. And we were able to raise a lot of funding because it is capital intensive in the semiconductor world. But it was interesting because a year after we started, right next door to us, as in literally across the street from us, competitors sprouted up with funding that was astronomical at that time. We were talking about billions of US dollars, and we only had like 500 million, right? So we felt a bit overwhelmed. But, you know, with our group and our team back then, we were able to come up and just focus on what we were trying to deliver, which is a better semiconductor wafer experience for customers around the world. And I was sent to the U.S. office and to help galvanize the sales. And the team there was fantastic. We only had probably no more than 10 people in the U.S. office, and we were able to generate over 25% of the company's revenue. We had targets that we were supposed to meet, and we met them, we surpassed them. And I think that's why we were able to go public at $8 billion on NYSE without too much problem. We were being pushed. Initially, our range was less than $5 billion, I believe. But due to the huge demand for it, we were able to push it up to $8 billion.
Let's move on now to Smarter. This is the first real estate tokenization platform. You're using the Ethereum blockchain, which we're big fans of here, to sort of facilitate homeowners and investors. Tell us more, please.
Yes. In a nutshell, Smarter is a platform that allows homeowners to liquidate a part of their home equity without accumulating any debt or have any interest rate sensitivity, and buyers to purchase that equity at a low threshold down to $1. And we actually customize an insurance policy to mitigate the risk. We believe that the ability to tokenize assets is extremely powerful. But at the same time, you need the legal framework and also protection. During this ICO period that we're in, a lot of people have asked about tokenization, which is great, but how are they protected? And we thought about it from the very beginning, that our users obviously are the most important aspect of this marketplace on both sides. And so in order to protect them, we had to come up with an insurance policy because, after all, we are a startup. When people use a startup company, platform, or any other kind of startups, there is that startup risk. What would happen if I invest something and the startup disappears? And we believe that in order to protect our users, we have to come up with a customized insurance policy that will protect their investment should anything happen.
It's a novel way of looking at lending and securitization. Let's say you have an emergency expense. There's really not the time and inclination to go through the traditional venues to procure those funds, presenting a whole new way for folks to tap in to a resource, to their capital.
Yes, we actually came up with the idea because we live, except for one team member, we live in the San Francisco Bay Area, which includes Silicon Valley. And I'm sure a lot of people know, a lot of people have all this capital locked up in their homes and their properties. But if you look at their day-to-day living, they are under strain. Of course, the salaries and compensation are a lot higher in this area, but that doesn't mean everyone's multimillionaire or billionaire. And so the way that people live here is not what's imagined outside. Not everyone's driving a Ferrari, not everyone's driving Rolls Royce. So there are capital and monetary needs for people who live here. And the only options right now are home equity loans or, if you're 62 and above, reverse mortgages, both of which are you're sensitive to interest rates. And for home equity loans, there's the debt issue, the accumulation of debt. And unfortunately, we've seen in the past that people get into trouble with that. And with Smarter, we believe that people can capitalize on their equity without, one, losing tenancy, and two, without accumulating debt. And that, we feel, is very powerful. And while the home equity debt market as of 2016 was over $150 billion, we feel that we can actually grow a new segment of that market where people who would otherwise not even consider it because they don't want any debt on their, you know, family balance sheet.
Now, I think you've covered the bases here on the general concept. I'd like for our listeners today an overview, if you could, on just how you intend to create value for the token holders, please.
Yes, so the tokens are legally structured to be vouchers. There's 75% discount on the purchasing fees on the Smarter platform. So, for example, if you were to buy a percentage of a few houses and the fees end up being $100, as an example, then with SRE tokens, then you get a 75% discount. So what you really end up paying is $25. So the platform fees are a percentage of what the value of the transaction. It's pegged at 0.5%. So you can imagine as the platform grows, as more homeowners get on the platform and more buyers, not just domestically in the U.S., but also around the world, the volume and transaction value goes up. And with that, the fees go up because it's a percentage. And you can imagine the demand for it will grow. Because every time people use the SRE tokens as it's designed to use, which is the 75% voucher, it is burned. So there are only 100 million tokens in existence. We will never create any more. And once people start using the platform, they start getting burned. And as they start getting burned, and obviously the number of tokens decrease, and you can imagine what would happen in terms of their value.
For folks who, like myself, listening, let's say a $200,000 mortgage, okay, with considerable equity, but there's just no current method or mechanism for accessing that equity without tacking on more of this debt that is a real concern that people have following 2007-2008 credit crisis. And what Smarter does is it allows folks to not procure more debt. It allows you to access what you've built up, some of maybe you might say your savings or your investment in the home, to access that as equity. Okay, moving on. Any other important details you'd like to share with the listeners?
One last thing is that Smarter, obviously we're a startup, but the concept of Smarter is almost recession-proof. While I do not wish it to ever happen again, but if the housing market does go into recession, our platform is actually a great way for homeowners to stay in their homes and buyers to purchase percentages inexpensively in areas that we're targeting, which are high-demand areas, because in the long term, these areas are growing. So imagine if the platform were available during the bottom of the last recession, and buyers were able to buy percentages of these various San Francisco properties. If you look at it from that bottom, which was 2011 in San Francisco, to the current time today, August 2017, those percentages would have, on average, returned more than 100%. So we feel that, you know, Smarter is good for both during the good times, also during the bad times. We just feel that we can serve a lot of people during all times.
I would like, you know, maybe to give folks an idea of, let's say, a worst-case scenario. Suddenly, the ECB and the BOJ send rates skyward, and our Fed policymakers decide to, send the overnight lending rate sky high. And suddenly, the real estate market just dries up, and we're looking at maybe something as bad or worse than, you know, the 2007-2008 housing crisis. If that were to suddenly unfold, can you give us an idea of any fail-safes or scenarios where Smarter will be better prepared?
Yes. So let me talk about on the buyer side first. So if the interest rates were to go up, and then people who are on ARMs all of a sudden, you know, realize that their monthly payments go up, our insurance monitoring system will be triggered to see, like, what happens to individual households. So if, for example, a mortgage payer cannot make his or her mortgage payment, then our monitoring system will trigger that, and we will investigate on a case-by-case basis because obviously we want to protect the investment of our buyers. But, you know, even before that, any home, any property that's put on SmartRent has to be equity positive, as in the homeowner has to have at least 51% equity in their home. So we believe that people who have 51% equity in their home, especially in these high demand areas that we're initially focusing on, will work really hard and try to find alternatives to stay in their homes and to keep their properties because of all the time, effort, and money they've put into it. Now, on the flip side, for people who all of a sudden realize that, wow, you know, home equity loans are not a viable option because of the skyrocketing interest rate, SmartRent, we believe, will come into assistance for a lot of these homeowners that need to tap equity lines. And when I say equity lines, they're not credit lines because, you know, the homeowners do not have to return this. The only time where it has to, quote unquote, return is when they sell the property and the percentages that was sold on our platform has to go back to our users. So on an interest rate issue, we feel that SmartRent will be very helpful for people who are looking for ways to tap in their homes without being sensitive or to these rates or also any debt.
Maybe a touch a bit more the automated process that SmartRent does or at least offers to investors.
Sure. For a SmartRent startup like, you know, us, no pun intended, we are a small company currently. And for us, without the blockchain technology, we would not exist. Because in order to hire a corporate middleman, if we had to go for a custodian bank or whatever, the costs are a bit too high for us. And even, I believe, for some medium-sized companies is also very high. So in order for us to exist, the Ethereum blockchain is very, very helpful because the smart contract is a neutral third party. You know, you just list the conditions that both parties, the buyers and the homeowners, agree to before it's committed. Once it's committed, there's no rollbacks. You know, the homeowner cannot say, oh, what I meant was something, something, or the buyers cannot roll back either. So we make sure that the conditions, just like in a normal escrow, all the conditions that both sides agree to are written into the smart contract so that when the boxes are ticked off on both sides, it is done and it is committed and it's immutable so that if there are ever a dispute, everyone can go on to the blockchain and look at what was agreed to at what time and in which way.
People will remember during the housing crisis, I mean, there were considerable concern who owned what. With all the securitization, the mortgage-backed securities were sliced and diced into tranches. You might have thousands or tens of thousands of mortgages, not even, you know, the folks who packaged and bundled many of these securities knew what they contained. Well, SmartRent has solved that, whether intentionally or not, by recording all these transactions on the Ethereum blockchain. You know, it's really triple entry accounting, and it's there for the world to see. All right, as we wrap things up here, can you give folks an idea of where the tokens will trade?
So, Chris, that's a very good question, but unfortunately, due to regulatory rules, we cannot talk about where they will be traded. Tokens are not considered securities. So, if we were to talk about it, unfortunately, we would breach some rules. But we understand that third parties will encourage exchanges to take up our tokens, and for that, that's out of our control.
So I believe, if I remember reading the paper, that Waves, Ethereum, what about Bitcoin or any others?
Yes, we accept four cryptocurrencies, Waves, Ethereum, Ether, Ripple.
Bitcoin, maybe, BTC?
Bitcoin, yes, exactly. And we also accept fiat. We understand that a lot of people, especially during this time of cryptocurrency trends, a lot of people want to use USDs instead, and we also accept that.
Oh, what about the yuan or the renminbi? Any interest there, or is it just U.S. dollars?
It is U.S. dollars for now. We actually considered the RMB from China, but due to a lot of issues right now, especially with what's happening over there, we decided against it. Please visit SmartRent, that's SmartRent.io, and there are links there to our Telegram, to our Slack, Facebook, Twitter, and feel free to ask questions. I try to drop in at least every 2 hours to answer any questions that people have there.
We want to wish you the most success and hope that our listeners will, you know, investigate more. I suspect you'll be hearing from Gold Seek Radio listeners over the coming weeks.
Thanks so much, Chris.
GoldSeek.com employees were not compensated in any capacity by Smarter. This interview is presented only for its informational and educational content and must not be construed as investment advice or as an endorsement of the Smarter ICO SRC tokens. Employees reserve the right to purchase SRE tokens.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%, totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. The quest for freedom and a better life knows no bounds. I was reminded of this in great detail on a cross-country trip this week. There's a section of Interstate 40 that runs from Kingman, Arizona to Seligman, Arizona, that is full of inclines, passes, and it seems, for the past several years, endless construction zones. It can be a challenge to cross this in an automobile. I have great respect for those who settled this land and crossed it by foot, horseback, and carriage. One of the last times I made this journey, I had about half a tank of gas leaving Kingman, thinking I would gas up 73 miles ahead in Seligman, but never anticipating that just a few miles outside of Kingman, traffic would grind to a halt and crawl along at a snail's pace for nearly 4 hours due to a massive vehicular fire miles ahead, of which we eventually saw the aftermath. The journey was complicated and risky, because nightfall approached several hours into this unexpected and prolonged delay. Cell phone service stopped working with multiple dead spots across what seemed like a never-ending 73-mile trek. And the car literally ran out of gas as we pulled into Seligman, Arizona, where gas prices were, not unexpectedly, about 35% higher. Every time we traverse that same 73-mile section of highway, it becomes painfully obvious how much more serious that fateful journey could have become, and how unprepared we often are for the ordinary circumstances that can go sideways, just up the road, with no recourse or ability to make a U-turn, that we simply have to ride out. But this kind of everyday challenge is nothing compared to the life-altering and devastating setback Hurricane Harvey has caused for millions of Americans. The death, homelessness, and financial setback of this event will reverberate throughout the entire economy for some time to come. Preliminary estimates forecast an economic impact into the hundreds of billions of dollars, surpassing that of Hurricane Katrina. How much of a ripple impact on the economy Harvey will have remains to be seen. The stock market is at a record high. Gold and silver remain highly undervalued. The true unemployment rate remains extremely high. Home prices have again moved into bubble territory. Subprime lending in the auto market is topping out. In short order, any event could cause one or all of these markets to seek true price discovery, which could mean a much lower stock market, a much higher gold and silver price, lower home prices, and less auto sales. Remember, ordinary circumstances can go sideways with no recourse or ability to make a U-turn that we will simply have to ride out. No matter how prepared you think you may be, it may not be enough to keep up. Do more, and when you can, help more. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%, totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.